Hello, and welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the Amerika-Zentrum in Hamburg. Today, we're launching a three-part mini-series about avant-garde jazz called The Sound of Chicago. The avant-garde scene in Chicago is famous around the world, but the music is notoriously challenging for listeners. So in this series, Dr. Douglas Cowie and avant-garde jazz historian Kara Rush, aka DJ Slim, will guide you through the history of the scene. Most importantly, they will also help you understand how to appreciate this very challenging art form. And just to give you a sense of how it sounds, let's start by listening to a minute of the first track of Anthony Braxton's 2001 album, Eight Compositions. And thank you to CIMP Records for giving us permission to share this with you.
Welcome to the Sound of Chicago podcast series at the Amerika-Zentrum Hamburg. In this three-part series, we are going to look into why the jazz of Chicago sounds different to that of the East and West Coast of the United States. We'll discuss the influence of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians and look into a little more detail at some of the musicians who developed their musical practice through participation in that organization. Your hosts for the Sound of Chicago Jazz podcast are me, Douglas Cowie, and Kara Rusch. I'm a writer and teacher.
I'm more in the music business, formerly known as Slim. I became involved with Cadence Magazine in the mid-80s, and currently I host a couple radio shows, and I'm a painter.
Excellent. In this first episode, we're going to discuss the founding of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, also known as AACM. And in particular, we're going to talk about the most famous and enduring exponents of the AACM principles, the Art Ensemble of Chicago. We'll try to give you an introduction to listening to a couple of Art Ensemble of Chicago albums, the live recording Baptism and the studio album Fanfare for the Warriors. And we'll also talk about what these musicians mean when they call what they do great Black music.
But before all that, maybe our first task here is to just set a little groundwork about the history of how jazz developed in Chicago.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Because Chicago, and we're going to start talking about how jazz is not the right word anyway at some point, but Chicago has, apart from jazz, it's not really, people don't think of it as a jazz city. People do tend to think of Chicago as a music city, and they usually go running for the blues, and rightly so. But like, actually, the story of music in Chicago, I mean, probably starts when, you know, people that we don't even remember anymore were playing music, and like Eastern Europeans playing polkas and mazurkas and whatever in the taverns and when they arrived. But the most important, for me anyway, development in Chicago music is like the gospel music of people like Tommy Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson. And I think there's a pretty clear line between from like them into the jazz recordings that were made by King Oliver's band and Louis Armstrong, and into the electric blues that develops in Chicago when the Great Migration happens and all these blues musicians are coming north to Chicago. And this all kind of directly builds up a legacy and a culture more than anything else that the music that we're going to talk about fits into. I don't know if you want to add a little bit of detail about some of those early days.
One thing I definitely noticed in revisiting the music of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which in my mind had sort of solidified as one thing, but in actually going back and listening to several of their recordings this past month, the biggest thing I did notice was how much they embody other musics, including gospel, definitely blues, and also music from other countries. And I mean, you know, Lester Bowie refers to his early start in gospel, and you know, he talks about all the like klezmer music and polkas and all that stuff, which was, I wouldn't say it's not surprising after listening to it, but it wouldn't have been my first go-to, you know.
Yeah I mean, I think when we start talking about what it's like to listen to this music, there's one of the things that you realize, I'm glad you said that at the outset, is like, the more you listen to the music, the more you realize how absorbent, like deeply absorbent of every sound these people were hearing, these guys were. Like they really listen. They're really great listeners. And the way that they transform their listening into playing is a really fascinating thing. And I guess, yeah, I think that's why it's important to talk about all these, this, it's not an accident that Chicago is the place that this music develops.
Well, right. When you first proposed this idea, I flippantly said, oh, the Art Ensemble Chicago, the Grateful Dead of the improvised jazz world. And I was
so
totally
mean.
It wasn't meant to be mean. I was just being kind of flip. But then in going back and listening to these recordings, it's like, it is all there. I mean, you would be, if you investigated any one thread of some of these, you would be, I always say you can learn about the history of the world just listening to music if you're curious enough, because it's all in there, at least in the type of music I listen to. It draws from, you know, many, many different roots. And I was really surprised on how many of their CDs there are just straight out blues on it.
Yeah.
Not in the necessarily chess manner, but that we can get into their sort of ideology about bringing the music to new places, advancing it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I wonder whether that's a good place to sort of, you know, advancing music is driving thing here, and that's part of the reason why the music that we're talking about, and this music specifically from Chicago, is so interesting, remains vibrant to the present day, which we'll talk about in future episodes. But the word advancing and advancement and the idea of progress in music, and it is a really complicated one. In some ways it's very straightforward, and in some ways it's a very complicated textured thing for the mm-hmm. musicians. And that maybe brings us to a point where we talk specifically about having glossed over an incredibly brief history of some threads of Chicago music. And it's worth pointing out that we're not going to do a comprehensive history of any of the musicians we talk about in this series or the subcultures and cultures from which they come. We kind of want to just give people an introduction and an overview to these things and some points of interest to think about and look up if they want to, and to think about while they're listening to these albums, which we hope you'll do. But turning to the like founding of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, which happened, that's like a specific date, the 8th of May, 1965. Some musicians who had been working together, Richard Muhal Abrams, Jody Christian, Phil Corin, and Steve McCall met together and kind of laid out some principles for how they wanted to behave. It's worth saying that one of those guys, Phil Corin, played with Sun Ra, who we forgot to mention in our history, and who's he is and isn't associated with Chicago in people's minds. You know, the Sun Ra Orchestra is based in Philadelphia and has been for a really long time, but he actually started in the 50s in Chicago. And I think some of the ideas and principles of Sun Ra, who's in some ways more familiar to general listeners, I would think, than maybe the Art Ensemble is, I don't know. But some of his principles and ideas are similar, right?
Absolutely. And I, you know, it is confusing. And like we said, we'll try to contextualize some of these, you know, there's always an argument of, you ask anybody from any state where something originated and they'll come up with a way it originated in their state. And I've heard that through talking to musicians my entire life is whatever it was the best where they were, which is cool. Very sort of, you know, into it and stuff. Sun Ra, yeah, it is. You know, he did eventually go do his thing in Philadelphia, but I think there were many of those types of formalized sort of organizations. You had Horace Tapps got out on the West Coast with the, you know, the I think he called it the orchestra, Pan-Asian Orchestra, and you had the AACM. And can we just, on the AACM is sort of the umbrella organization, because I don't want people to get confused about the Art Ensemble of Chicago. That would be like part of a group underneath that sort of organization.
Yeah, so it's worth maybe...
Probably the most well-known.
Yeah, it's worth maybe clarifying exactly that. So like I have a couple things I want to read out. One is from, we'll put the books that we refer to in the show notes for people to follow up with. This is from George Lewis's book, A Power Stronger Than Itself, which is a history of the AACM. Lewis himself is a trombonist primarily, and he's an academic, and he teaches music and is also an AACM member. Before I talked about the actual organization, I just want to say, like, this is what he says towards the end of his book about what's important about the AACM. He says, ultimately, the reasons why the AACM has become integral to the cultural identity of Chicago are relatively prosaic and can be enumerated at greater or lesser length. The deeper and more challenging question of why, despite the AACM's international, cross-generational, multi-genre purview, the Crucible of Chicago continues to be integral to AACM identity can only be hinted at in a narrative such as this one. That's at the end of a more than 500-page book. But like, I think it's important for a number of reasons, and we're only going to scratch the surface on this. And I think this fits perfectly to what you said earlier. It's like the answer actually lies in the music. Like when you listen to the music of AACM artists and artists that have been influenced by the AACM, you're finding the answer to that question of why is this group so important? But having been founded by these four musicians on the 8th of May, 1965, it grows into a big and as that quotation indicates, far-reaching organization. And I think one of the reasons for that is that they laid out some very specific purposes for what they wanted to do. And I want to read those nine purposes for listeners, because I think they're important. And I think they offer to this day the exact framework of what is so important and so great. And then at the one hand, very simple and yet complicated about what the AACM, an organization designed to cultivate musicians and musicianship, is for. So they came up with these nine purposes, and they read as follows: to cultivate young musicians and to create music of a high artistic level for the general public through the presentation of programs designed to magnify the importance of creative music. To create an atmosphere conducive to artistic endeavors for the artistically inclined by maintaining a workshop for the express purpose of bringing talented musicians together. To conduct a free training program for young aspirant musicians. To contribute financially to the programs of the Abraham Lincoln Center, 700 East Oakwood Boulevard, Chicago, Illinois, and other charitable organizations. To provide a source of employment for worthy creative musicians, to set an example of high moral standards for musicians, and to uplift the public image of creative musicians, to increase mutual respect between creative artists and musical tradesmen, booking agents, managers, promoters, and instrument manufacturers, etc., to uphold the tradition of cultured musicians handed down from the past, to stimulate spiritual growth in creative artists through recitals, concerts, etc., through participation in programs. So it's like a fairly detailed, but also fairly open set of principles. I think the keys for me about those principles is that they're about developing musicians of all types and all walks of life, and about positioning those musicians with respect to a community. And I think those two, that those dynamics, being really serious about getting really good as a musician and what that means to be really good as a musician, but also that a musician exists in various types of communities, including the ones they live in, including the ones that they play music with and do professional work with, is a really clear principle.
Yeah, and when I was reading over at least the initial founding sort of members of the AEC, mm-hmm. The thing that kept coming up was this is how purposeful the intention was.
Yeah.
So to actually just be clear on your intention, and it sounded like it was modeled. I mean, there were duties outside of music,
yeah.
Also services outside of music. It just sounded more clear that going into it, that you might be doing some bookkeeping, yeah. Or some booking or something. Like, it reminded me of the chess model, but actually you knew going into it what you were getting yourself into, in a way.
Yeah.
You're going to get out
of this a lot, and yeah. So you have to put in some stuff that you might not otherwise be intending to put in.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And I also think that the component of original music was also a very overriding component.
Yeah.
And they practiced a lot.
I mean, this is the interesting thing to me. So I'm going to skate over a little bit of AACM practice and history to get more directly to the Art Ensemble of Chicago, because I think the story of that group is emblematic and also just fascinating in and of itself. But they, you know, there's people coming in, musicians, professional musicians, young musicians, youth players, coming into this space and learning to play music. And I don't have it to hand, but there's a description of people coming in and you know, they want to learn to play music and they don't know how to play an instrument. So in like the first mm-hmm. lesson, they teach them some rudimentary stuff of like, this is how you push air through this thing to make sound, and this is the principles of how it mm-hmm. works. And then they start teaching them a little bit of music theory and saying like, here's what a scale is, and here's some different types of scales. And like, and so they have a lesson that does that. And then the next week they come back and they build on that. And the claim that's made, and I believe it based on the detail of the actual description, which is too long for our purposes here, but like, is that by the third time, these people that couldn't play in the first lesson, in their third lesson are already starting to compose melodies that they can play and so on. And it's because of the rigorousness mm-hmm. of this that lies behind these principles, these nine principles, that really that's able to happen. And, mm-hmm. and one thing that happens with the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which we'll probably talk about later, is that at one point they were practicing, you know, all day, every day, but playing like one or mm-hmm. two concerts a month. And so not making any money for all the work they were putting in. It's like, if you're going to put in that work, you need to earn money. But let's turn to the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which is, again, like, these are musicians who were part of the AACM and were involved in projects and practicing and running the organization, who formed their own ensemble because they had some like-minded ideas about how they wanted to make music. Do you want to just tell us a bit about who those guys are and
Yeah, we should probably talk about the founding, the sort of original group, because it's the Art Ensemble still exists. It got its start in the late 60s. I think, you know, when different people are credited with being co-founder, Roscoe Mitchell definitely was one of the co-founders. Lester Bowie also, you know, I did read an interview with, I think, Malachi Favors, where he's kind of credited and he says, he's very humble. Let me just start again. Roscoe Mitchell, he played a lot of different reed saxophones, predominantly Lester Bowie, trumpet. Malachi Favors was a percussionist. Joseph Jarman also on horns. Don Moye, did I get that wrong? Sorry, Malachi Favors, bass player. Duh. and Don Moye, percussionist. And I think at first it was supposed to be Philip Wilson, who ended up going out with Paul Butterfield, thought he would be back, consequently never made it back.
So there's a blues connection there as well, right? Like, already.
Definitely a blues connection.
Like, and one of the things is a lot of these guys were all playing in like R&B bands and blues bands and stuff. They were gigging musicians in clubs and stuff. It's worth sort of mentioning that as part of the background for what becomes a very different kind of music.
Lester Bowie says he was on a bunch of Chess recordings or things behind like Fontella Bass and that as uncredited, I think, because of probably the Musicians Union or something. Yeah. So I don't know if that can be substantiated or not, but I'm sure he would know. He it was in an interview in 1979, and he does go a little bit over that. And as far as, you know, it's interesting, Malachi Favor talks about never having a formal music lesson and that basically just being interested in playing something and just working his way through it. So it's not that I think the other intent there is the giving musicians agency to figure it out. It's not mysterious. Yeah. It's the overriding theme is you need to, it's hard work.
Yeah.
It's definitely hard work.
Yeah. I think that fits in also with like the listening experience, which we'll come to later. It's like, if the point of the AACM and of the art ensemble as a group within that umbrella is to give musicians agency to learn to play an instrument, to express what they want to express through the creation, the composition and performance of music. Anyone can do that. It takes work, is part of the ethos. And I listening to it, mm-hmm. anyone can listen to this stuff. And what you listen to takes mm-hmm. some work if you want to get more out of it. But it's also like the work you put into making it, it repays itself because you start listening differently and you start experiencing music in a different way. And that's, to me, a really exciting thing, is partly what I love so much about the Art Ensemble of Chicago in particular, I have to say.
One of the things I noticed in listening to a lot of their records is there's a lot, you know, sometimes it's not just one thing. I mean, I know I joke that it's always sounded like a long jam, but actually in really close listening, you will get everything from the avant-garde to sort of a, I want to say like the regalness of like European classical music.
Yeah.
You definitely get blues. Bebop is incorporated for sure. It's pretty interesting. Each record is a journey in itself across this musical omniverse. So, I mean, there are times where I think, you know, my feeling is a lot of the records opened up really sort of abstractly, and by the end, it was more succinct.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's just the ones I happened to pick out to listen to.
I think that's kind of true. I think about that as almost part of the practice, part of that, like a bunch of guys getting together every day and rehearsing together every day. And some of the principle of what they're doing musically is that every individual in the Art Ensemble of Chicago can play what they want, but they also have to be playing with everyone else. And that puts a very particular, I would say, intellectual and artistic and cultural pressure on an individual musician in order to do that. Because it's not the same as just playing any old crap, right?
Right. And I think, I think the feel that comes across is it's a very organic process. It's like it's in the moment. And of course, I think a lot of the records I did listen to happen to be live recordings.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about this a bit later when we look at the two records that I've selected for discussion, because one of them is a studio recording, one's a live recording. And I think some of the differences in them comes out in that. But back to the Art Ensemble, they're rehearsing every day. They're trying to find gigs so they can make some money, because part of the point of the AACM is that it's a self-sustaining organization. And it's another thing that's important about this, and this is where the term jazz starts to become, I suppose, an issue or a problem in talking about this music, is that, again, these are musicians who are gigging around with all kinds of other players as sidemen and whatever. In some cases, leading their own bands and playing, you know, jazz in bars. I read a statistic sometime around the mid 20th century, there was something like 75 jazz clubs in Chicago, which is just incredible. So, like, there's lots of places to play. How much they're paying is another question. But also, if you think about the experience of listening to music in a nightclub, you know, there's people ordering drinks from the bar, and there's people having a chat at their table. There's people flirting with each other and not necessarily paying attention to the music. And part of the AACM idea and the Art Ensemble of Chicago idea as part of that is that this is serious music. Like, we're serious musicians composing serious music together, and we want people to listen to it. Like, we want to have a concert in a concert hall and sit down and listen and pay attention to what we're doing, because this is our lives here. This is our expression of who we are individually, collectively, culturally. And like, that deserves to be listened to in the way that, you know, you don't go to a cocktail bar and listen to Mozart. Very highfalutin cocktail bar, maybe, but like, you sit there and you know, people don't have that on as background to their Friday night, their Saturday night.
Right.
And neither should they hear. And I think there's a lot of racial dynamics involved in this as well, that like, this music being made by these black people definitely belongs somewhere else. People don't let it into those environments. So they have to create that environment for themselves.
Right. I think when you look at the story of the AACM and several tales around the country, it does speak to the social situation of the time. And also when you talked about how they, when you look at like Motown, for instance, and they have finishing schools, basically, this was such a large part of that culture, was you had this sort of, you will respect me. And then that got maybe spun in different ways. The one thing I notice is, well, that's a whole nother subject about angry people in general. But one thing I did notice about the whole Chicago thing is it really doesn't come up. It's more, it does feel more of a collective respect.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me when you see image, it's just interesting to me how that, I don't know if it was carefully curated or that's just the manner in which it came out. I don't know. But certainly the race and the social aspects are part of the story. I think we're more focused on the music, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. But we're not, in other words, there's definitely an awareness of that.
I think some of the dynamic here, I think, comes from something we haven't quite touched on yet, is that these musicians that we're talking about, by and large, so you mentioned Malachi Favors not having formal training, but a lot of these other guys did have formal training, and they and Chicago is a particular place for that. And I'm like endlessly fascinated by these ideas, even though I don't know a huge amount of detail about them. But there's a couple of different schools and junior colleges in Chicago that had like outstanding musicians as their music teachers in these schools. So like, you go into high school band class or the marching band or the concert band or whatever, and the guys teaching you are these like incredibly well-trained, you know, high caliber, like concert caliber musicians who are teaching. And that's, again, there's a race story involved in there, because by and large, black classical musicians aren't allowed in the orchestras and, you know, whatever, but they're there in schools teaching kids to play. And these kids in Chicago, like Roscoe Mitchell and Anthony Braxton, who we're going to talk about in our next episode and so on, they're learning from these really high quality, like high caliber people, and giving, being instilled this sense of professionalism, this sense of musicianship, and this sense of ambition for themselves. One of the places that always comes up is Woodrow Wilson Junior College, which is now called Kennedy King Junior College in Chicago, where a bunch of these guys went and met each other and found themselves to be like-minded. A lot of them also learned to play in the army, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And you hear that in their music as well. They love at certain times playing little military bugle calls.
Yeah, the drum
and things.
Bugle corps. Yeah, definitely.
And that, again, that's a very highly professionalized environment to learn music.
Yeah. And on the south side of Chicago, you had DeSable, which you had like Joseph Jarman went there, Leroy Jenkins, a lot of people, Mulhall Richard Abrams went there. And that just seems like just a wealth of Eddie Harris went there. And I think in the Malachi Favors, he didn't go there. He went to a place called Phillips. So anyway,
Sam Cooke was at school there, I think, as well. Like, one or the other of them was in a doo-wop group that auditioned Sam Cooke and decided he wasn't good enough.
Nat King Cole went to Disable. So that legacy is definitely there, and that it's also a way that people met each other as well. And I believe the original Jazz Record Mart, Del Mark Records, was on the same street there in Wabash. Mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah.
Which a Chicago jazz story should have Del Mark Records in it, as far as fixing on the tradition. This is one thing I really did notice about Chicago jazz, as opposed to maybe other places in the United States. Like, I think in New Orleans, it mostly deals with the tradition and didn't get much mm-hmm. beyond the tradition. In New York, you're dealing with pockets of, you know, the downtown scene, which is a very kind of more white scene, maybe more European. And you had the 20th century classical guys that were taking over the thing. And on the West Coast, of course, you had the studio musicians and more of a cohesive sound. I don't think there was a lot of room for the avant-garde, at least we don't think of it. There are definitely players out there like Vinnie Golia and Horace Tapscott and John Jang and people that were involved with that, but it wasn't what was getting the press. In Chicago, the thing I notice is within even labels like Del Mark Records, they had the blues, they had traditional jazz, and they had the avant-garde. There wasn't a lot of like hard bop and post-bop within that, but it just seemed like these three very different sensibilities, but mm-hmm. equally sort of referenced. And some of the same players would be on all. You mentioned Jody Christian, who I think of more of as an inside player, but certainly, you know, in other words, there just seemed to be more room for we're not in a box, which is, again, we've talked about the terminology.
Yeah.
And how problematic jazz is. I know that after, you know, Cadence magazine started in the mid-70s, it started out as the review of jazz and blues, and at some point formalized after hearing all these interviews with thousands of musicians, and including many people in AACM, it ended up that the journal changed over to the review of creative improvised music, because that was it's clunky, but mm-hmm. in other words, it's a way to not pigeonhole, because so many of the musicians had problems with the term jazz. And I don't know if that was on an artistic level or an economic level, because jazz commands so little of the sort of music surplus in regards to funding. Anyway, that is one thing I think about the AAC. You would be hard pressed to define them by genre. Other than open-ended.
Well, they end up start calling
and it. And another thing I just wanted to point
out. So yeah, go for it.
What did they call it?
Well, they ended up calling it Great Black Music.
Oh, right. But again, that also could become a box or, well, I guess if you weren't, you know, and I guess actually black music would just be a type, and it wouldn't really matter where you came from. You could play it. One thing I, you know, and you talk about the upkeep of all of these, this, just the AAC in general. At one point, I think it was documented that there were over 500 instruments amongst the people involved in the AACM. And
that's incredible.
The traveling with, or the upkeep of these instruments, and how behind the scenes it was very, it was expensive to keep this afloat. I just wanted to mention one other thing about the art ensemble. When they first, because I noticed that all these groups you talked about, you mentioned Phil Cochran, who started out with the Artistic Heritage Ensemble. And I believe in the next episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, but these names. So the art ensemble originally came out, they were just the art ensemble. And it wasn't until they went internationally to Europe, I think it was Paris, that it was advertised as the Art Ensemble de Chicago. And then they became the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which just has such a, it's also very pro-Chicago. It puts Chicago on a map in a way that New York was probably already on the map.
Yeah. You know? So that's exactly where I wanted to go next, actually, and talk a little bit about the Art Ensemble going to Europe. in 1969 mm-hmm. and specifically going to France and to Paris. And then maybe we'll come back to talk a little bit more about great Black music. And then we'll talk about these two records, Baptism and Fanfare for the Warriors. So one of the interesting things about all this talk about the kind of music they were playing, the attitude that they brought to it, they found it really hard to find an audience for their music in their home of Chicago. It was hard to find concert halls they could book and get, you know, enough people into them to pay for it. And they did do a few concerts. They did one with Steve Reich, I think, early on in the mm-hmm. AACM. That's before the Art Ensemble of Chicago, I think. Or maybe it is the Art Ensemble.
Can I just interject
a
funny story? So because of the Steve Reich connection. So Joseph Jarman talks in an interview from, I think it's like from 1979, 1978, somewhere in there, how about their openness with just music as music. And John Cage went to Chicago, and so he did, so a bunch of the guys in the group.
Yeah, so I think it was John Cage. I was thinking of, not Steve Reich. Sorry, I got it wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, it was John Cage, and they do this thing, and John Cage at the time was interested in computers and stuff. As we've established, if you're listening and in the moment, you can contribute in what way you can contribute. And he gets done, and Joseph Jarman's mother, who happened to be in the audience that day, says, "Yeah, don't ever play with that guy again."
Listen to your mother.
So, but you know, the story really spoke to me in ways of just that it's not like, oh, I'm game to play with the Rolling Stones because it would at least be lucrative. Yeah. John Cage at the time, it's just a spirit of, yeah. We'll do this, and then someone having the right to say, yeah, no. So anyway.
So the Art Ensemble decided to go to Paris, really, because there just wasn't enough. They weren't making enough money playing their music, and they needed to keep themselves going. I've got a quotation from Lester Bowie about it. He says, "We were working in the States maybe four times a year, but we were rehearsing every day, and we had really come upon something that we felt like we could dedicate our lives to. I mean, I couldn't dedicate my life to being an R&B trumpeter. Malachi didn't want to just work at the Holiday Inn for the rest of his life. And we had a group that we knew had a unique sound, a language of our own, and we knew we had something to contribute to the music, and we wanted to do that exclusively. That was impossible for us in the States." So it's always interesting to me when, like, with all this community focus, and we're gonna bring in people like minded musicians into our organization, we're gonna give back to the community and contribute to this culture that we grow up in. When that culture doesn't respond in the way that you hope it will, you have to kind of go away to become who you want to be. And so they end up going to Paris, which they can do. This is really interesting to me as well, because Lester Bowie has a lot of money from being an R&B sideman mm-hmm. and from his then wife, Fontella Bass, who you mentioned earlier, who everyone knows from the song Rescue Me, mm-hmm. which, like, they just had a lot of money from pop records, essentially. And so he loans the other members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago the money to get them over to Paris. And I love the fact that this is like, it's a loan. It's like, we are going to be financially solvent mm-hmm. with this. And I don't read that in a mean way. And there's a really funny story about him coming in with a load of cash to convince them, because they were all kind of sitting on the fence about, understandably, like, you're a young guy from Chicago and you're going to uproot yourself and go to France. Lester Bowie had a family. Mm-hmm. But he comes in, he's so convinced to do it that he just starts like handing like $100 bills around or something. He's like, "There's your loan, like, we're going." and the kind of show that he puts on for it convinces them,
right,
all right, let's do this. But it's like, it's not just a charity. It's like, we're in this together. We're gonna commit together, and we're all kind of liable for what happens.
Right.
I really love that.
With a loan, there's definitely some skin in the game there, and it, you know.
Yeah. And I imagine we'll talk a bit more about Paris in our next episode when we talk about Anthony Braxton, who was mm-hmm. over there at the same time mm-hmm. as them as well. But, you know, Paris is the place to go. So it's got a history of American artists that goes way back. And it's particularly got a history of African-American artists, of Black Americans going to Paris as a place where they can cultivate their art in ways that they can't at home, where there's an audience for their art that there isn't at home. And that's not without its own problems. It's a place where Americans mm-hmm. go when there's not the conditions they need at home. And I mean, it works for the Art Ensemble of Chicago. They go over there, they basically hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. They go in the summer of 1969. They recorded 6 full-length LPs in 7 weeks.
That was the BYG stuff? Was that on that, yeah. The actual?
Yeah.
I don't think it was lucrative for him, but obviously kept them floating. In one of the interviews, I remember, I think it might have been the Lester Bowie saying they got paid. Not much, but he said they got paid. So then it jumped over to, you know, Germany, because they also did a lot of work in Germany and were picked up by ECM, who... That's a label that Manfred Eicher, I think, was co-founder of. But also, I think it was a time where there was this sensibility of removing oneself out of the mainstream sort of status quo and doing something different. I believe the first record that Manfred Eicher picked up was an American. It was Mal Waldron. I think it was a piano trio. And then... I was trying to figure out how the connection to AEC might have come about with Manfred Eicher. So 4 records in, he records like Marion Brown with Anthony Braxton. And Anthony Braxton was also ended up being part of that Chick Corea group, Circle, I think. So these were all like early American things. But I think the connection might have been Gunther Hampel, a German multi-instrumentalist. They recorded him, I believe, in 1968. And I think that's somehow where the connection comes in.
Yeah. And I mean, while they were based in France, they were, you know, they were playing shows in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in fact, I think it's in Germany, in a show in Germany, where they meet Don Moye, Famadou Don Moye, who becomes their full-time percussionist. He wasn't originally the percussionist with the Art Ensemble, but they end up getting to know him better in Europe, and he joins the group full-time. But let's move to talking about the albums. But first, I want to just come back to this like problem of jazz and the idea, or the solution, I suppose, for lack of a better word, that the Art Ensemble comes up with it, which they call great black music. I want to read a few quotations here from this. This comes from a book called Message to Our Folks, which is a book about the Art Ensemble of Chicago by a guy called Paul Steinbeck. It's a terrific book in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
He takes you through a history of the group, but also does very long, detailed readings of recordings they made, which are really fantastic for trying to figure out how to listen to this kind of music. But in talking about great black music, so he's quoting here Malachi Favors, and he says, in Favors' recollection, the two bandmates, Favors and Lester Bowie, quote, had a big debate over the labeling of our music, which lasted for hours. We finally came to the conclusion of great black music. And that's the end of the quotation. And Steinbeck says, the term caught on within the AACM, Bowie claimed, because it represented something broader than jazz. And then here's those two guys again talking about what they're trying to drive at with this concept of great black music. Malachi Favors, a lot of people criticize us for using the term, but as I know history, no one ever gives black people credit for doing anything. No one else is going to say that this is black or African. Even in so-called jazz, people have tried to take that away from us or say that so-and-so did this when actually our ancestors did it. That's why we have to stress these terms. Bowie, I went and saw this cat with the Senegalese ballet. He played a song that was 2,500 years old, and it had the whole of the sonata form in it. Now, what were they doing in Italy 2,500 years ago? We were always led to believe that all they did in Africa was drums and dance. We never knew about all these cats with circular breathing, reeds, oboes, choirs, everything. Man came from Africa. Even the scientists admit to that. So does the music. That's why it's so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And then one final thing. This is Paul Steinbeck talking about Roscoe Mitchell. It says, Roscoe Mitchell believed that great black music was one of the major traditions worldwide that could provide a super musician with a, quote, well-established background, a necessary condition for mastering composition and improvisation. In the late 1960s, though, critics and audiences did not always recognize that the music of Africa and its diaspora could provide a solid foundation for a group of would-be super musicians who wanted to achieve total music mobility. And this, according to Mitchell, is why the Art Ensemble had to invent the concept of great black music. Well, nobody was calling the music great.
Yeah, and that, and also Lester Bowie was a co-founder of BAG, the Black Artist Group as well. So again, even with the...
They were based in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly where Miles Davis comes from, and,
And Lester Bowie, in fact.
Yeah, yes, Lester Bowie actually was born in, but I think he was schooled more in Chicago, right? So,
yeah.
And I think that again, that all this labeling is important. So I think we're going to talk about the records. But one of the things I noticed, and I don't remember, I don't believe it was on one of the records we're going to talk about, but it might have been on, I don't know if you've heard of this art. So they also have their own label. The AECO has their own label. Mm-hmm. And one of the things on there is a 2-CD set called Salutes the Chicago Blues Tradition, which is a hoot to listen to. I mean, they're doing Hoochie Coochie Man and that sort of stuff, and their own stuff as well. But on one of the records that I've been listening to, they do at the end chant great Black music. This is great Black music and stuff. So
we got two recordings that we want to talk about as a way of just introducing, I suppose, what it's like to listen to the Art Ensemble of Chicago. We can't, for rights reasons, actually play this music on the podcast, but these two albums are both available streaming. And
we can point you to some songs, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll point to some specific tracks and stuff. But these two records are interesting, I suppose, for a few different reasons. They're both on Atlantic Records, and they're both around the same time. So the first record is called Baptism. It's a live recording from the 1972 Ann Arbor Music Festival, Blues and Jazz Festival. And it came out in 1973. And then the second album is a studio album called Fanfare for the Warriors, which came out the following year, 1974. So I think one of the things that was interesting to me about listening to these two albums a bunch of times side by side is that they're from the same moment in time. They sound quite a lot different in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. They sound similar in other ways. And the fact that one is a live performance mm-hmm. and one is a studio recording makes them different and interesting listening experiences in different ways as well, from my point of view.
Right, and one of the things about the live performance, now I'm a big believer that you don't necessarily need to know anything to enjoy music. It is helpful sometimes, though, to have a context. So as you mentioned, that was recorded at the Ann Arbor Blues Festival in 1972, which the main stage would have had all the like chess recording blues artists there.
Yeah.
And so if you think of that in the context of it, what audience they were playing to, for me, it just sort of helped in the sense that, one, what would it be like to go to a blues festival kind of expecting to hear Muddy Waters and Otis Rush and these sorts of things, and then have these guys come out. We haven't gotten to the face painting or anything. And certainly,
no, I was just going to go ask you to talk about that a little bit. Maybe.
Well, and to have, this group of musicians come out and expecting maybe to hear like a classic sort of blues thing. And then having, I mean, the opening track on that is Don Moyer doing a percussion piece, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
If these were issued in the order, I'm assuming they were, but.
It sounds to me listening to it that it is like a kind of continuum.
Yeah, because by the end, they're definitely the audience. They're definitely won over by the audience, I would say. Like at first.
Yeah, so it's fascinating because what you say is like, so I actually have the compilation record that mm-hmm. That was put out of this. You know, they like make these compilations to sort of advertise the festival, and I have that LP, and it's like, you know, Bonnie Raitt is on there, and Muddy Waters, you mentioned. It was like a tribute to Otis Spann, who had just died. So his wife sings on that, and like a beautiful tribute mm-hmm. to him. Sun Ra or Orchestra was on that bill as well. Dr. John. I mean, they're an interesting fit. And as you say, they come out and you get like this four on the floor bass drum. So like, okay, like I'm with this so far. And then it just goes absolutely haywire. Like the other guys are all picking up stuff off tables and rattling them. And I think that some of the things to think about with the Art Ensemble is the performances. You say some of them painted their faces. So I think Jarman and Favors in particular and Don Moyer.
Yeah. And Roscoe Mitchell did not paint his face. I mean, the important thing to note is.
And neither did Lester Bowie.
Yeah. And part of his reasoning, one, it was, if you wanted to, you could. It wasn't, it was, it wasn't a statement that was handed down. It was sort of like what you want to do. One of, from what I can tell, Roscoe Mitchell, it's just the logistics of it gets hot, he says, and he says, you know, you end up playing this instrument, I'm sweating, I'm wiping it so it gets all over everything. And so it was just sort of a logical thing to not paint his face.
Yeah. Lester Bowie liked to wear a lab coat at one point.
Yes, like he was on stage. I feel like that's part of the messaging, like he's a doctor, you know what I mean? Like,
I'm a scientist nerd here, like,
we're here for a serious but fun operation. And so on that opening where it is a percussion, a solo percussion, you know, that next track, and I didn't notice this before, but the second track is IMMM. It's a Malachi Faber thing, although in an interview, I think that was supposed to be UMM.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if that's the one where there's just actually some really harsh crying in that one. I don't remember if that's a track.
That's the second one.
Oh,
the second one.
I found that.
There's like a transition from the first to the second where the first one is like this huge percussion thing. It starts with like a four on the floor bass drum, but that creates a bunch of different rhythms and swells and drops away and comes back. And then the transition becomes all this like hollering, like really anguished screaming. You can imagine if some guys are on stage, the performance is part of it for them.
Yeah.
Like the visual aspect of performance, which you can't get on a record anymore, you couldn't get on a record either. You can't get on a record is my point anymore, as in the live performance was it. And although you can watch videos of them performing to get a flavor of it. But yeah, it's kind of harrowing.
I found it very difficult to listen to, the way I find sometimes that it's like you don't want to turn away. But when you hear a baby crying, there's something about that level of whatever it was in those voices that was so uncomfortable.
Okay. So I found the first few times I listened to this album, I found that I didn't know what to do with it. It just made me, like you said, maybe uncomfortable. And then the more I listened to it, the more interesting I've found it, because it starts to, after a while, there's all this anguish shouting, then it's like a percussion instrument. It's like maracas being shaken really slowly, or like a thing being like a rattle being sort of manipulated. It's almost soothing. And you then get a gong. And then you get words emerging in French at first, then in English, and then you get this poem. It's worth saying, Joseph Jarman met like William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg when they were over in Paris, and was quite taken by, even before that, by the beat poetry movement, and really involved himself in writing poetry. So a lot of the words I assume you're hearing are his poems being declaimed amongst the music. And you get him declaiming these lines over and over again. And then the anguished cries that started become like a very sing-song, and it becomes almost like a field holler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, and this is what made me find this particular track, it's a hard listen, but really moving, is it starts to feel a little bit like a theater performance of like Middle Passage into Slavery kind of thing, like as I'm imagining a narrative to.
Right. And going back and looking the whole record, so then after the screaming part we're talking about, it sounds like the next part to me sort of starts out as a dirge. I mean, maybe you're like to like a lullabyish kind of thing. It's very interesting. And then they start in with the free, like my track listing is off, so I have to go to the title, so I don't want to say track four because it's they sequence this not correctly.
This is track three.
The Unanka.
Oof, that's noon.
Oh, so the Oof Noon, right, is the right. So okay, so I think I have a Kotri issue, and I think they got the index points incorrect on it because of the introduction they hadn't accounted for. Anyway, the Oof Noon is where it starts getting very free and loose, and then the next track.
That's also one that starts with this, what you described earlier as like almost like European high classical, right?
Yeah.
With all these long tones and like really complicated harmonies, all the wind instruments are playing.
And then the next piece is a Joseph Jarman piece, O Nadaroth. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. That's like a 15-minute piece. And that's where they sort of, the free jazz improv gets more into a cohesive it gets very, very cohesive, especially on the last track, Odwalla, which I think it might have been my favorite track. That's a Roscoe Mitchell track, which is
It starts with all that great trumpet playing.
Yeah, and it must be bass sax because there's no baritone credited on that, but it's definitely sounds like definitely low on the bottom end.
Yeah, low sax.
And to me, that was it was the most straight ahead. That's not why I liked it. I just liked it because but I also wonder if I liked it the most because it was a culmination of everything that came before it, right?
So that's what I was going to say. Like, listening to this, like, I had a couple of thoughts about this, and that's exactly one of them, is that actually I think that this performance on Baptism is like, it's designed as, like, almost like you can listen to it like a symphony. Mm-hmm. Like, there's different movements, and you get those opening things, like you get this, the percussion solo kind of spreading some territory, creating some territory. You get that second track that has all that vocal work in it. And that's kind of like a first part or a first movement. And then you move into the second movement across those two tracks where all the reeds in particular are there. Mm-hmm. And it moves, like I said, and you alluded to at the beginning of the discussion, like there's the like almost high European classical sound that gives way to all this other stuff. And then Odwalla, the last track, is kind of a third movement where all this stuff kind of comes together into a real coherent form. And it's almost like they've taught you how to listen to mm-hmm. them in order to present this last thing. And I think listening to the art ensemble, usually what's a way to kind of figure out how to listen is to like listen for those transitions between one thing and the next, and also listen to who's coming in and out, like what instruments are coming in and out. And it's not that necessarily means anything, but it's just like thing, like focal points for your ears mm-hmm. to grasp onto and start thinking about what's happening in the music and like where there's changes coming. There's one part in there where they're like, they just seem like they're all just playing as fast as they can and challenging each other to keep up. And it's really exciting. That's at the end of the fourth or fifth track, Ona Daruth, where they're just like, it's almost like just out of control bop of some kind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's well, and if you look at the title, I mean, it kind of, you know, Baptism, I mean, it's, I'm not versed in my religious thingies, but it's like, it is like going through an entire, you know, trying to think of the word, like, an event, so to speak, of that. So it's
I mean, it is. It's a performance, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely aptly.
So that makes sense.
Titled, and that's why I also say is you don't necessarily need these pointers to appreciate great art or good art or any art, but it does help sometimes to have a context and a way to sort of listen to it. Even though I like to throw everything away at first and just hear it and not be told anything,
just hear
because
it.
Sometimes it's very edifying for me if I go back and say, "Well, this is what this felt like to me," and then to find out it's called Baptism or whatever journey,
it is. You're like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, it's like okay, and that's why I say, like, most of the times I feel like your ears will, and you're on a cellular level, you'll figure it out if you just give yourself some space to figure it out, you know, and stuff. So I think we should also talk about Fanfare for the Warriors.
Yeah, let's do it. And then we can wrap up. So this one, I mean, what I think is interesting about this is that as a studio album, I think that each of the tracks is a little more, sits alone a little bit more than they do in the live performance. But at the same time, they all do also add up. And oh my God, I think this album is so much fun.
It definitely is fun.
I really love this album.
So the first track, Illustrum, I don't know if I'm saying that, Malachi Favors. So that's the one though where they tell the tale of Odwalla, is that right? Is that the...
Yeah, that's right.
And so to me, you know, it's just my own thing with narration. I mean, even Gene Shepherd on Mingus is the Clown, after a while it's like, okay, I just don't want to hear anybody telling me anything anymore, right? That's just my own thing. So probably I listened to this album to reacquaint myself with it. If I was going to skip a track after about halfway through, I'd be like, okay, I got that. I want to get to two, because two for
me. But on the other hand, mm-hmm. That first half though is great because it's just sounds like trains moving around in like the stockyards or in the train yards or something.
Yeah.
Like, there's all these whistles and kazoo and trumpet, and it gets a little bit faster. And it, to me, it just sounds like the trains moving around. I mean, I was born in Elmhurst, Illinois, where there's a big old train yard, and the trains used to crawl. Well, they still do. They just crawl through town, and like to me, it was like, oh, they're kind of. They're making music about place.
Yes, absolutely.
But the second track is the most fun you're ever going to have on on an album. I think
I
just
agree.
So great.
The Lesser Bowie track. It's called Barnyard Scuffle Shuffle. And to me, and you know, that really brings in those. It's very spirited, but it's almost got that European circus feel, like the way Willem Bruker from Holland would incorporate into his collective. And also, I also hear, you know, in these records, a very sort of sometimes broke horn sounds. I don't know, like a very classical hearkening, you know.
Yeah, they're always playing around with them. So like, I have ludicrously detailed notes for this 5-minute and 12-second song.
Okay, so yeah, I don't. So we'll let you.
And I was like, piano, lounge jazz that very slowly departs, slightly odd chord progression, and then 1 minute, everybody in together on their own thing, winds percussion, 129 bass drives a bop section, everybody follows 15 seconds or so, 154 swings. Almost like a big band blues goes from swinging to a more jerky rhythm or straight rhythm, and then 308-ish energy playing, I called it, and then 322 back to swing, horn swinging, bass less so, love the contrast, and then it just says ... end. Like there's a point where like the horns are really swinging and the bass line is playing super rigid. And it just sounds so exciting to me. Like it's like it's not quite uncomfortable, but it's not quite comfortable either.
Right.
And you just hear it's like there's this description that the music historian Richard Crawford has of Bob Dylan's "Like a Rolling Stone," mm-hmm. and he at the end of this thing talking about how it works, he says like, "But what this really is the sound of a bunch of musicians having a great time," and what this song is. Yeah. It's like it's just the sound of a bunch of musicians having a great time. But also having a great time at such a ludicrously high, complex level.
And the level of references in there, you know, and I'm sure every time you go back, and to me, this is why jazz or creative improvised music is so exciting, because you're not going to hear the same thing every time. And also there's space mm-hmm. in it. It's not, you're not going to get right to the core. Yeah. There's space. And so the whole time, you start out, you anticipate the chorus or whatever it is that you're the point you are to get to it, but over extended listenings, then you hear what's happening in that space as well, which is to me why it just broadens the horizon instead of narrowing it down to a soundbite. So, you know, which is.
Yeah. Well, that's that thing I alluded to earlier, right? Of like the principle driving these musicians, or the nine principles of the AACM mm-hmm. driving that group culturally and musically, and the Art Ensemble of Chicago within that, taking on those principles and interpreting them within this ensemble and thinking like, okay, you can play what you want as long as you're listening to everybody else, creates mm-hmm. It creates the sound, it creates those spaces, because everyone, mm-hmm. you know, you can't just close your eyes and ears and blow, baby, blow. You have to listen to how it fits with everyone else. And you have to create that space organically to be able to listen and move. And that's why those transitions are important. That's why people coming in and out is important, to thinking about what's happening sonically in this stuff.
Right, right.
It's what's so exciting about it to me. It really thrills me, this music.
Yeah, yeah. Which is hard, is a struggle against like the EDM that's so popular, is it just goes to the thing and it stays on the thing. And
and once the thing's there, it's there. And it's not going anywhere.
I mean, there's several analogies we could make, but I'll abstain from that. So what did you think about the title track, Fanfare for the Warriors?
I love that it's not a fanfare. Yeah. you're expecting to get like some big, like, mm-hmm. where's my fanfare? And there's not, I think it's a really I think it's a really interesting piece. Again, you get like, I love the all the winds do these long notes with these piano stabs. With these long notes of winds.
Yeah, so there's seven tracks on here. I was most struck by track two and the last track, which is only a minute and 15 seconds, and it's called The Key. Well, here's what I think about it. They cover a lot of ground in a minute and 15 seconds. It's pretty interesting. That minute and 15 for me just really would just kind of summarize the whole spirit of the AEC and their just their depth of abilities and knowledge in all of the traditions.
This is that great black music idea, like being compressed into a minute and 15 seconds of music. Like, it's here's all the stuff we've heard, here's us expressing it, take it out somewhere else.
It was something. So yes, I came far, far from my original, you know, sort of jerky statement about the AEC, which
the Grateful Dead. I just want to remind everyone of that here at the end of the hour.
How callous I, how flip I can be. I have such confidence in great art in general, because my feeling is, for me, it's about your relation to that great art. It's there. It's always there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you can access it is really, I'm not saying it's not the responsibility of the artist, but it's really not. It's the person. I'm a listener that when everyone tells me that this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, I want a piece of that action. 90% of what passes in the mainstream as the greatest thing since sliced bread, I don't get, but I at least, but, you know, as someone who enjoys artistic statements, I want to feel, and at the end of the day, sometimes it's like, yeah, it's not, it's about something else, but I do feel the confidence in listeners to be able to determine when something is real and sincere in its intent, and when it's just sort of kind of jive. And that's a one thing you had said to me, and I kind of did have the confidence we had talked about. And I said, I know all I have to do is when the time comes, just sit down and just give yourself over. And that's exact. I had it, it's there for the taking, so to speak, you know, and it may be under the umbrella of great black music, but the thing is, it's for everybody to enjoy, because long after these people have all died and long after it's there. And that's what I love about having access to a Coltrane record or Charles Ives records or whatever it is, it's there. It's a gift in a way, you know?
Yeah.
And I love that.
Cool. So in our next episode, we're going to take a look at two, I guess, next generation, so to speak, of AACM musicians. We're going to look at Anthony Braxton and Cahil El-Zabar, and in particular, the Ethnic Heritage Ensemble. So please tune in, listen to us, continue this conversation and see how some of these ideas develop with different musicians. But before we end this episode, I want to end it on a quotation from Muhal Richard Abrams, one of those founders, the key founder, really, of the AACM. He says this: "First, we make for ourselves an atmosphere in which we can survive in spite of this environment, simply through that which we have in common. We have something in common. For example, we are in agreement that we should further develop our music. Whatever else we do outside of our central development, we will not let this central development be destroyed." Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.